Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens, and due to technical difficulties, Kathleen can't be with us today. So rather than delving into what Kathleen and I have been doing in France, Spain, and a bit of London and Belgium, we're going to go into that next week. But as chance would happen, I was out today in Edinburgh and with a very interesting person and a longtime friend of mine. And so rather than interviewing her in a few weeks from now, we decided to bring the interview forward. And our special guest today is Eileen Hall. Hi, Eileen.
Hi, everyone. It's nice to be on the Spirit Revolution. I'm a big fan of Philip and Kathleen, and I'm glad to be on the show.
And for those of you who do not know Eileen and who have not seen the photograph, Eileen is the daughter of Stan Hall, and you might have seen her in season 2 of Ancient Aliens, where she was talking about her dad's work and specifically his legacy and what he has been doing. So in a few brief words, or however long you want to, basically, what did Stan do? And specifically, of course, what we're talking about is a very interesting subject because to just touch on something, Kathleen and I will be on Ancient Aliens this week, and the episode this week is called Temples of Gold. And that's very much a subject which has been touched upon in previous episodes of Ancient Aliens. And to some extent, Stan's work very much had to do with a Temple of Gold as well.
Well, that's correct, Philip. My father was basically the one who organized the 1976 expedition in Ecuador to the Tayos Caves. He did so after reading Eric von Daniken's book, Gold of the Gods, where he describes this, big treasure of gold and artifacts, golden artifacts, along with a metal library and a crystal library, which can be found in these caves in Ecuador. Now, Dad, of course, was someone that had to kind of prove things. So he decided to mount this big scientific expedition, one of the biggest ones of that century, to go off to Ecuador and see whether these claims in Eric von Daniken's book are true. He had the British and Ecuadorian governments and armies involved, top scientists at the time, and he also managed to get Neil Armstrong to come down as the honorary president. So they went into this cave system. They didn't find this alleged treasure or metal library, but they did find a few artifacts from cultures, let's say 1500 BC, around about there. There was a mummy in a tomb. So my father, because he was so interested in the missing history of the continent, you know, South America, and he believed that Ecuador was quite a key piece of the puzzle in solving a lot of the mysteries behind the New World and its connections to the Old World. My father stayed in Ecuador to follow the story of the Tayos treasure as far as he could, and that involved him getting to know all the key characters and the protagonists behind this story. And he put it all into his book, Tayos Gold, which is available through Amazon and through Adventures Unlimited Press. You can find out more about this on the website. And I'm basically, after my father died, I just decided to keep going with his publishing his books, managing his website, and any other projects, you know, that come along the way.
Well, your dad has the distinction for really being, and Eric von Daniken has actually said this, I think, on a number of occasions, that really he felt that your dad was the so-called nail in his coffin, because what was happening at the time was obviously that in 1968, Eric wrote Chariots of the Gods and became a much celebrated, but also in various corners, a much despised man. And when he went on with his other books, Gold of the Gods being one of them, he really was put under a microscope. And it was specifically the conversation which Eric had with Juan Moritz to do with the Tayos Cave, in which the German magazine Der Spiegel jumped on. And from Juan Moritz, who your father knew very well, basically Der Spiegel got a quote which said that Eric von Daniken never saw the Met Library. He never saw the Taos cave. And all of a sudden, the international media had all the evidence they needed to basically say, well, there is no Met Library. Von Däniken has made this up and so many other things. And then when your dad organized the expedition, it was like a further confirmation, if you want, of a scientific interest into this. But your dad wasn't a skeptic. Your dad was, if anything, convinced that underneath the story which Morris was telling, there was a very important truth, a very big story. And basically his mission was nothing to do with trying to expose Von Däniken or trying to prove certain things, but basically in trying to find out the origins of Juan Moritz's story. And it's something which took him, as you say, the rest of his life, which you've taken on as well. How did your dad behave? How did your dad go about in search of this final truth, this Met Library?
The first, apart from the expedition, was getting to know Juan Moritz and his background and his work, because Juan Moritz is the one that went to the media in Ecuador to announce the discovery of this cave and this treasure, where allegedly, because there have been a few expeditions to this specific cave in the southeast of Ecuador, nothing has been found to date. But because Juan Moritz notarized the document with his discoveries, he was the first person Dad went to. And that's where, I mean, Dad had already started research into South America being kind of the missing link in prehistory and history in general. He believed the New World's actually the Old World, and Ecuador could play a bigger part in kind of the development of the Americas than we think it previously did. But that was something that he was researching, and when he came across Juan Moritz's work, a lot of their theories matched, you know, in terms of global migrations back in, you know, a long time ago, when they thought these cultures couldn't even write or do many things. They were, according to Juan Moritz, crossing seas, trading and all sorts. And then you go into the thing is, you open this Pandora's box of stuff. But if you want to just stick to my father and his story, he got to know Juan Moritz. They worked on a few things together. Juan Moritz was very, he guarded his information very well. He wouldn't let go of any of it just easily. Dad was the one person, and Juan Moritz said he would tell where the treasure is if he would tell anyone. Fortunately, Moritz died in 1991 suddenly of, I think it was potassium deficiency. But he had always mentioned someone who had told him about this treasure in the first place. And Dad had never really chased this up because, out of respect for Moritz, they were very good friends. But as soon as Moritz died, Dad kind of went, oh, I wonder who this person is that told Moritz about the cave in the first place. And he chased this man down. Turned out he's an ex-army officer called Petronio Jaramillo, who claims to have actually seen this treasure in his teens, went into this cave. The source of that, his information, still, you know, debated whether it was his uncle or maybe the Shuar people he was friendly with. But turns out Petronio, he claims to have gone into the cave through an underwater entrance off a river, and this, you know, just seen this huge treasure, you know, chamber after chamber of golden artifacts, jewelry, skeletons covered in gold. But the most impressive part of it is this metal library. Again, what he believes was made out of gold or some sort of alloy material, with very strange symbols, and the books basically so heavy he struggled to lift them up. You get more kind of detailed information in our website in the book, but just to give you a general overview of the treasure, it's supposed to contain this library of hundreds of metal books and crystal tablets, which can't even be scratched with a knife. Petronio, of course, had no idea where they come from, He was just an army officer, but Juan Moritz believed it came from some advanced civilization, and it could possibly be linked to Magyar's, got Magyar connections, but he believed that it would tell basically the history of humankind, you know, completely change what we think is our origins and all sorts. And because my father had, he couldn't just believe anything you told him. My dad was someone that had to really analyze and investigate everything, any claims anyone made. It's why it took him 30 years to write his first book. You know, everyone said to him, the best stories and you need to get it out. But he went right very deep into pre-Columbian history of the Americas, and to even further, he went even further until he could come up with a plausible, I suppose, story and historical background to how such a treasure could end up in a place like Ecuador, in a continent like South America, where no such thing has ever been found before. You know, all his research into Tayos has gone into his first book, Tayos Gold, and then his two novels that follow, Tayos Dawn and Tayos Fever, he uses fiction to come, you know, give you a lot of the historical background. And then I'm happy to announce that Savage Genesis has been trying to get published for years now, Savage Genesis, that contains all of the rest of his research into prehistory and why he believes that South America is the key, you know, key to our prehistory. It's a missing link, and Ecuador to be the place where the rest of cultures developed in the Americas, kind of this epicenter of prehistory. So you've got all the rest of his research into Savage Genesis. It's not until you actually get into it that you realize just how much Dad went into, you know, the range of information, of subjects. I mean, I find it hard to get my head around. But anyone that's really interested in knowing a bit more should check it out. You can get the link to buy it through the website goldlibrary.com. But yeah, so my father was in Ecuador for 30 years. He tried to organize a second expedition with Petronio Jaramillo. Unfortunately, when that was getting put together, Petronio was killed near his home where he lived at the time. And that kind of fell through. Dad tried to organize smaller expeditions by himself to estimate, according to Petronio's descriptions, where this cave would be, because Petronio always said that Juan Moritz was looking in the wrong place. He knew where it was. You'll find people in Juan Moritz's camp saying Petronio was wrong. I mean, you're always going to have this battle of interest there. But Dad, what he did, what you'll find is coordinates on his website to the place where he estimates, you know, very, you know, it's kind of this area. You can't really pinpoint this kind of stuff in Ecuador. But Dad did a few reconnaissance trips, and he was happy to say that he believed the treasure was there. He hadn't seen it, but it'd been enough for him. And that's why he wrote his books, and that's his legacy to carry on.
And it's obviously something which you've taken on. So here you are. You're not born at the time when the expedition happens. You are born in Ecuador. You spend the first decade of your life in Ecuador. Then you come back to Scotland. Then in recent years, you've gone back and forth. You've lived both in Ecuador and in Scotland. First of all, how is it to grow up with knowing that your dad, or did you not know that your dad was involved with these kind of things? And then also, you have this balance of living in Ecuador, where obviously it's local, but then also living very far off Ecuador in Scotland, where it's not so much the case. So kind of give us some personal background to growing up with this story.
Well, growing up with this story was very strange in a way, because I could never tell people what my dad did, you know, because when he was in Ecuador, he was an engineer, civil engineer, when he was living in Scotland. But I, you know, when he moved to Ecuador, he continued more the Tayo story and, you know, had jobs on and off. But for most of it, he was organizing expeditions or organizing to have national parks and all sorts of different projects. Dad was all, up and down all the time. I met a lot of the people involved. We used to go around to ambassadors' houses. We used to go see Petronio, these people and that people, and you just think, oh, they're dad's friends. And then it's not until you grow up you're like, oh my God, that was, so so, and this was the ambassador to the US, and dad was, he was the best person in terms of contacts in Ecuador, and in my opinion, the most reliable source for this story, just because he went back and forth between the Ecuadorian and British camps, and well, just anyone involved in the story in Ecuador, which is you won't find with anyone else's research on the topic. So for us, it was just kind of. It was really nice, really interesting. Dad always had the best stories to tell, and no. I mean, it's still strange, actually. I still find it strange to think I've got a dad that did all these things. But so then we moved to Scotland. Ecuador has always been a very unstable country politically, so we moved here because it became unstable again, and it's not the safest place to be sometimes. So. Me and my sister managed to get a good education back here in Scotland, but after my dad died, he died quite suddenly from cancer back in 2008. I hadn't really been involved with his work previously. I kind of, when I grew up, I found out a bit more and a bit more, but dad always tried to protect us. And it wasn't until I got involved with his work I found out why. Right, it's not just a case of just, oh, I'm searching for this lost treasure. You can't even begin to comprehend all the. I mean, I still can't manage it all. I must admit that sometimes I've been way out of my comfort zone, out of my depth, not knowing what to do, frustrated, and that's why when I go, right, Dad, I can see why you didn't get us completely involved with this when we were growing up. It's just too much. And when you read his books, I mean, I'd like to hear from anyone who reads Savage Genesis. I'd like to get reviews on this from other people, because that's quite a handful for anyone to get their head around. But I'm really keen on anyone out there to get in touch and let me know how they get on with Savage Genesis. Anyhow, I went off to Ecuador after Dad died. And I was determined to get going what he was gonna call an online museum for some pre-Columbian pieces which he rescued in Ecuador. It's a large collection of mainly replicas from coastal cultures of Ecuador. You've got pieces from what's 3,500 BC to 1,500 AC. Like I said, most of them are replicas, but they're very good replicas, and Dad's idea was to get them photographed and get them up on and like I said, a virtual online museum for anyone to have access to. A lot of history before the colonial times in these countries is not very well known about, and it's really interesting the technology these cultures had back in the day. They still can't figure out how they made a lot of the gold artifacts and some of the ceramics. Ecuador has some of the oldest stone and ceramic pieces in the continent. So I went off to take pictures of that, found out all the complications that come behind being the daughter of someone who's done all these things in Ecuador. Although I had a lot of doors open for me from just being dad's daughter, I also had a lot of adverse reactions just from people. Some people in Ecuador kind of thought, foreigners come in, do their expedition, they thought my dad had stolen treasure and all sorts. So I was met with a lot of controversy as well as a lot of praise. But in general, it's been okay. I've been glad to get the books out, and I've been back and forth to Ecuador. Yes, every time I do something more towards Dad's work. At the moment, I'm going back to study for a bit. So, in terms of getting involved for, too much as I was before, kind of taking a step back. We did Ancient Aliens, and after that, we published Savage Genesis. I'm hoping to get another book of his out later this year and see where that takes us, really. Yeah.
And I mean, being your dad used to tell me a story about how the Ecuadorian mindset at on occasion was such that I believe at one point a TV crew just burst into your house and basically ran to you and your sister's bedroom because they believed that somehow your dad had stashed the treasure of the cave under there, and that you know, the idea that somehow the Taos cave hadn't been found in the 1970s was a lie fabricated by himself and the British. So kind of like that must, as a young girl, be so bizarre.
Oh God, it's the most bizarre thing, because we get a call, you know, we moved to Scotland, we get a call from our family kind of going, your house has been on TV over here, and they're kind of saying you've ran away with treasure that belongs to this country. And we were just like, oh God, you know, there's unfortunately a lot of resentment in, I would say, in Latin America towards any, you know, any country that used to try and colonize them, basically. You know, any foreigners come in, you know, do their stuff, take, you know, they're always going to accuse foreigners of taking stuff away from them, right? And unfortunately, there was this one guy who was into his alien research, but somehow he got involved in Taos and just basically thought dad had taken stuff away, because there was always this rumor flying about that the expedition in 76 had taken boxes, you know, mysterious boxes away with stuff which people thought was a treasure, because they wouldn't let anyone see it. Dad has obviously tried to clear that up many times, but as usual, you know, fantasy kind of wins. People like a bit of controversy, and, you know, what are you going to do? I can't just sit and just fight with all these people. I just let them be, yeah.
I can say the treasure is not in Scotland at the moment. But, I mean, Ecuador is I find, kind of like the great unmentioned one. We all know about the Incas in Peru. Obviously, we know about the Maya in Mexico. When you make the argument for those cultures, most arguments begin that somewhere around 1 AD, these cultures develop. They then become bigger empires, and then roughly just before Columbus happens, they are gigantic empires. And then obviously the arrival of the white man, in this case Spaniards, basically destroys these civilizations. And then some of the treasure is melted down. Some of it is said that by the Incas is stashed away. The treasure of Atahualpa, which you can probably expand upon a bit, is potentially linked with Ecuador. But Ecuador itself, as you say, is rich in history, and we kind of like tend to forget that. So kind of, should I see Ecuador as a completely separate culture? Is it completely alien to Peru, or are we having a more global area going on there, which basically has only been cut into two pieces by modern borders?
Well, yeah, that's exactly it, Philip. Before the Spaniards came, the Incas had kind of taken over a large area of what is now, well, I suppose, Ecuador and Peru. And it was the Spaniards that kind of drew lines and said, well, we're going to have Ecuador here, Peru there. But before that, there was all these cultures were not separated by any borders. You had coastal cultures in the Andes and in the Amazon. It's an important thing to know about this area is that it's unique geographically and geologically, because you've got the tropics being traversed by the Andes mountain range, and you've got whole array of ecosystems. It's one of the most biodiverse regions on Earth, and it also meant that it's culturally, it was also biodiverse, very diverse culturally. It still is. So, and you had all these great cultures. They're not as well known, I suppose, because they didn't leave big pyramids, you know, they didn't leave all these monuments We've got most of them is just earth mounds, you know, tombs. We've got a lot of ceramics and stone things that survived. And then what actually happened is the Incas started to make their way up to Ecuador. Ecuador is where they met most of their resistance, so they couldn't go further up from Quito, which is the capital, and they couldn't even go into the Amazon. You know, the Shuar kind of have kept people out for a long time. So South America was broken up before the Spaniards, actually, because it was already in war, you know, with the Incas dominating, kind of wiping out a few cultures. And then the Spaniards came, which just confused things even more. And it was easy for the Spaniards to kind of conquer just because everyone was in conflict anyway. And yes, the Atahualpa treasure comes into this because there's a few stories behind the Tayo's treasure, and it's linked to the Atahualpa treasure because when Atahualpa was captured by the Spanish and they asked for gold, well, of course, the Spaniards got their room full of gold, but it's also known that a few, messengers, priests, divided the treasure and went off to hide it in two different places. We've got one of them is the Yanganates region in Ecuador. They said that it was taken to some caves there or somewhere. I mean, they put it somewhere, although caves seem to be quite popular for these things. And the other treasure just went to the east. You know, that's the only kind of clue we have. Well, they tortured these priests to get that information out of them, and that's the only thing they said was east. Francisco Orellana, I think was his name, went off into the Amazon to look for El Dorado, and he went through this whole area, and of course they all died in the expedition. Well, not all of them, the expedition didn't get far because it's the Amazon, and so there's connections with the Atahualpa treasure, but that's still not very clear whether the same treasure as Atahualpa is the one in the caves, or whether it's completely separate, and the stuff that's in the Tayo's caves even older, actually. Yeah.
And you mentioned the tribe, the Shuar, and they're kind of like the key to this story. And they are an indigenous tribe. They are the ones who live in the area where the treasure is located. Your dad was a very big supporter of their rights, and also making the world aware of this tribe and who they were. Before going into that, I think I always found it interesting that your dad had this very old film, then video, then DVD tape of Father Crespi and the Shuar. He was the man who went and worked with the Shuar almost a century ago now. And he's, of course, later on the person who becomes famous for having very mysterious artifacts in his library. And he is said to have accumulated this because the local Indians came to him and gave this to him. And, of course, he's one of those people who was visited by Eric von Däniken on his travels as well. And an awful lot of his material was photographed by Eric. Your dad made contact with Father Crespi as well, and there's some very lovely footage of the two of them, specifically showing how Crespi really was a character, kind of like showing some of the artifacts. The Crespi collection, after his death in, I think, 1980 or 81, got dispersed. Maybe you know something about it. Its current status in Ecuador, but it shows you that there is a far, you know, like when we are told sometimes about, oh, there is this priest who has these mysterious metal sheets, oh, but you know, something has disappeared, and then there are rumors that they are faked by locals. When you read it like that, it's a standalone, oh yeah, maybe, but really it's part and parcel of a far bigger picture, and it's when you look at the bigger picture that you really begin to see something emerging, which I think is far more interesting, and where you begin to see how the story of the Metal Library and the story of Father Crespi and some other stories really begin to get together, and you realize that they are just parts of this larger story.
Well, yeah, that's right, Philip. Father Crespi was a well-known character, and he was a character. You can see some of the footage on the website and also on Ancient Aliens. It appears for a bit. It's really interesting. And Father Crespi was alleged to have been given, tablets from this highest treasure. The only problem with the Father Crespi collection is that because no one would take him seriously, because some of them thought, well, I think some of the Shuar did maybe just make stuff, you know, fake stuff to give to him just because, you know, the exchange thing, and he took it. He had a large collection, and because no archaeologist or just no one actually bothered to date these pieces or to really have a look at them, still very enigmatic, is a big enigma whether they were originals or not, or whether they came from this treasure or not, or some other parts of Ecuador. Nobody took their time. And when Father Crespi died, I went to see a couple of years ago what had happened to the collection, and the priests in the church where the collection was told me that some of it went to Europe. They wouldn't even give me the name of the person that took it to Europe. I've got a feeling it's Klaus Donner or someone like that, maybe. And they said the original pieces, whatever was original, stayed in Ecuador and went to the Central Bank Museum. So then we went off to the Central Bank Museum and we said, can we have a look at the original pieces of the Father Crespi collection? They kind of went, well, no, they're kind of in the back and you need a letter of permission and all sorts. And bureaucracy in Ecuador I've come across so many obstacles there. So when I come across too many obstacles, I kind of leave it. So in terms of Father Crespi, that's where we left it. We might never know. We might actually, unless someone takes the time to chase after these pieces, but who knows where they all are by now. But yes, you're right in saying that it seems that when you look at the bigger picture, it's not just, oh, there's, you know, it's randomly, there's treasure in Ecuador where nothing like this has ever been found before. We don't know much about South America. We all think it was, you know, the New World, la-di-da. But you start looking at the Atahualpa story. There's, Taya's Gold outlines them quite well. There's also, I suppose, Fawcett and Diet come into this a bit, Percy Fawcett. And you've got the Father Crespi, you've got there's El Dorado. What else have we got there? I mean, all sorts. And you've got the Juan Moritz part of it. It's actually really interesting, and Dad thought it was well worth having a look at, because there's plenty of evidence, and more has been found all the time, that Ecuador and these coastal cultures back in the day were big traders, you know, and traveled large, long distances by sea on balsa rafts made out of the special wood only found in South America. So this story emerges, whereas when, you know, we keep thinking, oh, how were they able to make all this? And now it's coming out that they were maybe the Phoenicians of their time. They traded, I mean, they were an epicenter for trade. They had advanced technology to do metallurgy, you know, ceramics, the techniques they have. And you see a lot of these pieces, just the design and the quality. I was very lucky to have handled this collection, because you go, oh my God, I can't believe, you know, you think the Incas are impressive, right? Yes, their structures are impressive, although it's been argued that it wasn't them that built them, but that's a whole other story. But and then you look at all these artifacts in Ecuador, and there's a few in Colombia as well, and you just, I personally had no idea. You know, I lived in this country, I was born there, I had no clue people from there were capable of such quality craftsmanship, and I'm still amazed. And that's, I'm trying, unfortunately, the museum I'm trying to get together is just being done on my free time. So, which means it goes very slowly, and I mean, getting funding's hard for any kind of these things. So I'm just doing it on my spare time, and hopefully get that out as soon as possible, because I keep talking about it, and I'm quite, I suppose, passionate about this, just getting out more information about pre-Columbian cultures in Ecuador. Dad believe that to be the first step into discovering more clues to this puzzle, because all the accounts we have are, you know, the best accounts we have are from Spanish priests in the time of the conquest, right? But then there's very few stories from other sides. And we've got, it's a really tricky puzzle to put together, but there's plenty of information there. If anyone wants to continue with this kind of work, you know, Dad left all his research, all his investigation in his books. It doesn't have to be just me. Although, you know, I kind of chose to continue with this. But if anybody wanted to continue this kind of research into Ecuador, all the information's there. Yeah.
You're saying that this imaginary border, you know, between Peru and Ecuador, and it's just south of this border that you have the great city of Corral with its pyramids, which are 3,300 years old. There's in the near future going to be pyramids nearby there who are going to be even dated older, to about 3,400, 3,600. That's BC. That is like the era where you are saying that in Peru some of these artifacts have been dated to as well. So you find that the oldest pyramids currently in the world, if we leave the Bosnian pyramid to one side, really are in that area. And as your dad always said, the new world was the old world, and that is slowly emerging. And that is something which has really only been happening in the last decade. Corral is something of the last decade. A very good book is 1491 by Charles Mann, who's just written another book called 1493. But in 1491, he goes into the archaeology and the history of how this continent was basically the year before Columbus discovered it. And what I found interesting, and there are so many interesting things in the book, but one of the more interesting things is a section on metallurgy. And it basically goes that 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago, people thought that the locals did not use metals. And that has really changed in recent years. And Mann points out that what they were doing was that they weren't using metal in the way we are using it, which is in a very practical manner, but that they were using it as a display, as a symbol of power, a symbol of wealth, and specifically that they used the metal and made it into very thin sheets of metal, which is precisely what we see appearing in the collection of Father Crespi. So what you have is science and archaeology coming up with confirmation of things which Crespi, your dad, and various other people were proclaiming in the 1970s at a time when science wasn't accepting that. But now science is there, but science doesn't seem to want to do a retro analysis of what Crespi, your dad, and various others were doing. So there's still an awful long way to go. And it's an interesting thing that really so much from that era is now being confirmed as being genuine. But unfortunately, as you say, in the case of Crespi, the collection might have been lost, or at least is not easily consultable. So going back to the treasure, this, you know, what is described by Petronio is definitely not something which is normal. It's something extraordinary. It's something clearly designed by somebody to be stored there and safeguarded. So speculating maybe wildly, it's there. So the question is, who put it there? What did your dad think? What do you think? What do others think about what the treasure of the metal library, the gold library, whatever you want to call it, really is?
Well, yes, we have to speculate because none of us can know this for sure. But the title of Dad's book, Highest Gold, The Archives of Atlantis, gives you a big clue. You know, Dad ended up kind of coming to his own conclusion. We have to, you know, emphasize this. It's Dad's conclusion again. Like you're saying, science has taken a long time to catch up, so you know, maybe in 100 years time we'll be saying, oh, maybe Dad, you know, maybe Stan was not you know, correct in this. But anyway, yes, he believed Atlantis to be Ecuador, basically, and that these archives were maybe part of this Atlantean civilization or something older or something different. Maybe it wasn't even, you know, who knows, that they put it there to safeguard whatever, you know, they were trying to get, you know, I suppose safeguard for posterity. We've got a metal library that maybe holds our whole history. Maybe that's another speculation. Juan Moritz also went down the Atlantis route a bit, although he also suggested civilizations from maybe outside the Earth. You know, he went into as far as saying maybe from, I think it was Ursa Major kind of place. But again, speculation. And Dad definitely believed it was an advanced civilization. And every time we've got science catching up with these people, we find that, yes, these cultures were more and more advanced. So who knows if we're going, you know, we go back in time, it's more advanced, actually, and we still can't figure out how they did something. So I'm hoping the science will catch up sooner than it has been doing for all this time. And what else can we talk about? I mean, that's it, yeah.
But also, obviously, the location of this treasure. And I always felt your dad had a very interesting approach to this. Normally, locations of anything are kept secret, and your dad shouted it out. He sent an official letter saying, this is where I think it is. And he had a very interesting approach to it. He basically said that he felt that this was never, he had mounted the expedition in 1976 and he knew how hard it was. And he always said that somehow the regime would safeguard this from ever happening under a bad regime, so to speak, that basically it wouldn't come there. And Kathleen and I, we've had this kind of idea because we are exposed to so many of these ideas and stories that somehow artifacts seem to preserve themselves, probably most famously written out when in the Grail story, where it kind of says the Grail will protect itself, it doesn't need a Grail family to protect it, but also that they survive, specifically things to do with the Passion of Christ. The Turin Shroud is probably the best example. They endure, and somehow, despite earthquakes, whatever, the fact that something which is thousands of years old but still exists, at least in the 1950s or 60s when Petronio swims into this system, is in itself extraordinary. And kind of like, you know, that it's still there in the 21st century was definitely an indication your dad had when he finally identified where it likely was, and when some members who were with him kind of like began to enter and pinpoint the system. So as I said, I thought it was extremely interesting that your dad is so open about this. But where does that leave the treasure hunter? Do they all rush there in the hope of finding it? Do they think it's far easier than it actually is? And kind of like how, what is not necessarily your role in it, but kind of like your role as an observer as to what is happening?
Well, I mean, first of all, Dad did not agree with secrets. He basically believes, you know, that leads to no good. So he was always very open with any of his research. I mean, what's the point in hiding it? You're not helping in the research if you're hiding stuff at the end of the day. So he got it all out of his books and out there into the world. And yes, a lot of people underestimate just how difficult it is to get anything done in Ecuador. I mean, you try and go in there and do anything, you can't. And this is the thing, I once had someone say that until someone goes in further into the cave than my dad and his expeditions did, they've got no right to criticize, you know, or throw stones at him. Because, you know what I mean, we've had lots of people in Ecuador kind of going, oh yeah, we went into Tayo's caves, here's our theory. But it's like, well, you've just done what my dad did, right? You're just repeating things that have already been done. You know, we kind of need to move on from that. And me as an observer, I've just seen all these different parties getting involved, especially in Latin America. And I have to say, unfortunately, most of them haven't read Dad's book, which is quite disappointing. Maybe, I don't know, I'm assuming they don't speak English or something, but it's like they're just redoing a lot of stuff Dad did. If people just read the book and then take it from there, instead of kind of going, oh, let's just try and prove Stan right. Yes, I mean, it's a very tentative subject, but you just need to get your hands dirty, in my opinion, right? I was in the caves in January this year, yeah. I was on a bit of a personal mission. I had Dad's ashes, and I had been carrying them with me for a while, and I just thought it was time. After doing all this work, you know, on his books in the museum, I just thought I've got to get to where he was, you know, doing his expeditions. Now, the cave that the expedition in 76 went to is no longer available for anyone to enter because there was an Ecuadorian television channel went in there, filmed, and angered the community. So that community's not happy with anyone going anywhere near it. So that wasn't an option for me. But I actually am always more interested in Dad's coordinates that are in his book and in his website. So I managed to make it with a bit of difficulty. It's not easy. To make it to this cave, I was able to kind of leave his ashes there and put that to rest. For me personally, emotionally, it was a journey. It was more of a pilgrimage for me because that was the same time I decided it had all become too much for me and I was going to take a step back from this. Just in terms of the area, if for any treasure hunters, I suppose, although I'm not sure I agree with that. If I'm coming from an Ecuadorian point of view, I'm Ecuadorian. I do not agree with anyone coming in trying to loot our treasure or anything to do with mankind. And interestingly enough, I like your point of things looking after themselves because Dad also, I think he definitely believed in that because he just thought the treasure is not going to be found, but it's going to find someone. Right, he always said that, and him and Juan Morris believe maybe it's not even the right time to find this treasure. You know, they thought society or the world wasn't ready for it. You need all this whole load of background and education to anyone to try and even begin to comprehend what's maybe in it, because it would flip history upside down. Right, the history we know it wouldn't even fit into the whole Taya story. But the area my dad, well, generally the Amazon area in Ecuador and I would say in Peru is undergoing a very difficult time. You had in the 70s, you had the petrol exploration people going in first. That was okay, but now the current governments want to exploit Ecuador and Peru's natural resources, which means, and unfortunately they're obviously bang in the middle of the Amazon rainforest and also the area that the caves are supposed to be in. So at the moment I would not advise anyone to go anywhere near that area, the caves, the Amazon. Yes, of course there's tourism, go to the touristy areas, but just anywhere else, the Shuar or communities will shoot you if they think you're a miner. There's a bit of a civil conflict going on at the moment between the the mining, the government and the local communities who do not want to have big scale mining and petrol exploration in the area. So for the time being, just keep out. What was my other point I was going to make? It was to do with that. Dad would never encourage anyone to go in. We've had a couple go in, nearly get killed, actually. There's been a few people going in and had feedback kind of going, oh God, that's a lot harder than I thought it was. And I'm like, yes, it's the jungle and it's Ecuador. And so I'm happy to have got involved, have gone all the way. I've been to the caves and I was lucky enough to meet someone who's mapping the caves in Ecuador. He's a Shuar guide who's into his cave-in, actually, luckily. He just happened to mention to me that there's 10,000, he says, around 10,000 caves in Ecuador and only 70 have been mapped. Right, so like I said, get your hands dirty job if you've got a few years to spare and lots of money to spare and you want to get yourself into some caves and map them. I mean, yes, Dad's estimates are a good guide, but I went along this riverside and there's hundreds of these caves. Some of them are blocked, actually. The one that we went to had been blocked in one branch because of roadworks, you know, earthquakes, anything. And you could be in these caves and you can get stuff falling on you. I mean, not the most pleasant place to be.
And, you know, what I always find interesting is, of course, that these things were hidden in places where it was difficult to get to. It's useless hiding a treasure or something where basically all you need is a tiny little hammer and a tiny little paper-thin wall and to knock it down and there's a treasure. It's not really hiding it. So, but, you know, over the years, and a good friend of your dad, Chris Winter, he has been doing an awful lot of research into the Mitchell Hedges skull and crystal skull, and he's been the one who pointed out to me that Mitchell Hedges was a person very much like Petronio. Well, Petronio was local to Ecuador. Mitchell Hedges obviously wasn't. He was a British person traveling into the Yucatan region and other parts of Mexico and Central America. And he uses fiction in White Tiger, a book which is really autobiographical, and you can see how autobiographical it is. But at one point, he is taken by the local priest to a site and is led down a system of caves, and the priest shows him a treasure as well, which he says contained crystal skulls. And the assumption is that the famous Mitchell Hedges crystal skull is basically something the priest gave to him to kind of like show to the world some enigmatic object of a lost civilization. So this idea of treasure being hidden, of information being hidden, of a lost civilization, a lost culture being hidden in the new world, which should become redefined as the old world, is not just something which you find in Ecuador, but also definitely in Central America as well. But we have a few minutes left, but basically I want to go back to 1976 and your dad, because what I find is probably the most amazing aspect of the Tyus expedition is the fact it was your dad. He was, as you said, he wasn't wealthy. He wasn't a high powerful man in the sense that he was a minister or somebody in a governmental position who could pull strings. He was an expatriate who lived in Ecuador, who was able to set up an expedition which involved both the British and the Ecuadorian army. And basically, anybody who watches TV knows how hard it is to just get any army to work on its own, let alone work together. The circumstances for the expedition were pretty atrocious. When you watch the footage, you can pretty much see it raining all the time. Nothing of this kind had ever been done. It involved helicopters. It involved so many things. And on top of that, he also managed to get Neil Armstrong, you know, the first man on the moon, to be there at a moment in time when America was celebrating its bicentennial, and Armstrong was the most asked man probably in America to be at all of these places except for the president, if not maybe more than the president. So his story has always been something of what you can achieve as an individual and how you can really leave a legacy. And really, your father just refused to accept. No, he had this drive of continuing to go. He, you know, whatever happened, he didn't stop. He just, I don't think he even saw it as a stumbling block. He just kind of like pretended it wasn't there and just went on from there. And as I said, he did that, and he managed to pull off an expedition which other people have never been able to repeat, but also he managed to pull it off in record tempo. Really, that is something which I think is another extraordinary aspect to it. And how do you look upon that? And kind of like, what kind of a lesson or an example is that to you, your daughter, but also his daughter, but also how do you feel other people should look towards this legacy of your dad?
Well, my father to me is one of the most inspirational people I know because of this, Philip. He was an ordinary man doing extraordinary things. You'd see him, you know, you'd see him walking down the street. You could never imagine what he's done. And it was just Dad's relentless search for the truth, right? Like you say, he stumbled upon so many obstacles, but he achieved so much, and he just kept going. He kept going until he could no longer go. I think we should all have that side in us. You know, we shouldn't just settle You know, we shouldn't just settle for what we're told is happening, for what we've been told happened, because we can all sense that there's something not quite right with history, with our society, which comes from the history we've had. And, you know, a lot of people forget or don't know it comes from, you know, history has been written by the victorious. You know, you get the one side, and that didn't settle for this. I think I can't speak for him. I can just say myself, I've been blessed by his books and his research. It just cleared up so many things to me personally about life that I just hope it can do the same for anyone who's a bit, you know, looking for something more, who knows that history is basically wrong, I suppose. It's Eric von Daniken's book, I suppose. But yes, the history we know is wrong. And if you're looking to get more, you know, search for this truth, whatever it is, because we'll never be able to grasp it fully. No one can ever say for certain, but we can come as close to the truth as we can, which is what Dad tried to do. And I hope you can all see this, his honesty and his hard work in the legacy he's left for everyone. Yeah.
Well, our special guest today was Eileen Hall, the daughter of Stan Hall. The website is goldlibrary.com. If you want to read more about Stan's book, there is a book called Tyus Gold, which you can get via Amazon. You can also go via thegoldlibrary.com. And we will also put a link up on our own website, which is thespiritrevolution.com. If you want to hear parts or the entirety of this episode of The Spirit Revolution, again, there are several ways of doing this. You can go for the spiritrevolution.com website itself, where there is the five last episodes always online. You can go to iTunes, where more than a year of archives are available. And you can go to the BBS archives, bbsradio.com, where all of the episodes of a year and a half are available to download. You have to become a member for that, however. Normally, Kathleen would say the farewell message here, but it is now up to me to say, until next time, the truth against the world.